let's start chanting the Metta Sutta, first of all. Okay, so here we go.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living being there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as the mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Is anyone here today who is new to meditation practice? Or everyone like old timer is? Old timer. Okay. Okay, doesn't really matter that much. The talk is going to be pretty much the same thing anyway, so whether you are new or not, it's all the same. And it's kind of handy, isn't it? This is one of the things about meditation practice. It is about, very often, about just understanding the standard instructions in a deeper way, and kind of allowing them to sink in, and understanding how they gradually transform you. So the same instructions really apply all the time. It's just that they gradually transform you, and as they do, they get a different meaning as they come kind of go deeper inside of you. So this is one of the things. That's why the instructions can usually be very simple, but actually they can still have a profound effect on you over time, gradually. So one of the most important things about meditation practice, obviously, just to relax and to enjoy what you're doing and just kind of sitting here. Of course, the difference between relaxing in the right way and the wrong way is, of course, significant. If you relax in the wrong way, you sit here and you end up falling asleep, and you still have a good time if you fall asleep. But the idea is to be awake with the relaxation. And that is really what distinguishes meditation from ordinary relaxation, that you sit back, you have clarity, you have mindfulness, and you know what is going on. But what we often need to do, one of the things about meditation, we need some skillful means to enable us to give rise to that mindfulness and then to sustain it in during the meditation. And this is often kind of the hardest part. How do we stop the mind from getting tired or from drifting off to thinking about all the things in the world that are kind of, you know, important in our lives and all of these things? How do we do that? And how do we give rise to a sort of inner brightness and joy that enables you to stay with the breath or stay with your meditation object? Usually here in Ambre we tend to talk about breath meditation, and one of the reasons we do that is because the Buddha emphasized the breath meditation a lot. It is called Anapanasati in Pali. Did you know that? Yeah? Okay, one person. Yes, few know that already. That's a pretty nice word to know, isn't it? Anapanasati. Makes you sound like a specialist in Buddhist meditation if you say that. So this is a Pali word, ancient Indian word for mindfulness of breathing here. So how do we do that? How do we stop the mind from thinking or from... how do we actually avoid, rather I should say, the mind from thinking too much? And one of the ways of doing that is to remember that the things in the world are always going to be somewhat problematic. If you want to find real peace and happiness in your life, you're far more likely to find it inside of yourself during meditation practice than you are to find it in the external world. We tend to prioritize the external world, all the things that happen in our lives, our families, our work, whatever it is. But actually, what we should really prioritize is our inner personal development, because that is where you have a chance of finding some real peace and happiness. The external world is always going to be, to some extent, there's going to be some happiness there, but it's also going to be a degree of problems in that external world. That is why when you see the terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka recently, 260 people dying, whatever. That is why when you see that, people often get a bit upset and they get angry, or they get, you know, at the very least they get sad and they get, you know, some degree of grief because of these things happening. If it can happen in Sri Lanka, it can happen everywhere. It affects all of us when these terrible things happen. But the point is, it doesn't really help to get angry or upset about it, because often that just perpetuates the problem. Then we get upset, and then maybe someone takes revenge, and they take revenge on the revenge holders, and it goes on like this forever, you know, round and round in circles. So it's not really worthwhile taking revenge or even to get angry about these things. I read this in the newspaper somewhere, this is quite a few years ago now, and that had to do with Afghanistan, I think, when the British were invading Afghanistan 100 years ago, whatever it was, and the Afghanis were really upset because it was only just recently that Alexander the Great had invaded Afghanistan. They were saying, oh, 2,300 years ago, you came, you know, it's only recently that you came here, and now you're coming again. So they still had a sense of resentment towards Alexander the Great 2,300 years ago. This is the wrong way. This doesn't work. If you think like that, the world is always going to stick in your head and it's going to kind of carry on forever. So don't do what they did. That was the wrong way of thinking about it. So instead of doing that, you realize that the world is always going to be problematic. Whether that world is our family lives, even family lives that end, they have to end the separation eventually. Eventually someone is going to have to die. That's just the way things are. Whether it's work, eventually the work is going to come to stop one way or another, or the world at large is going to let you down. And once you realize that world is always some degree, to some extent, yes, there's happiness there, but there's also problems there, then you start to withdraw a little bit, and you start to find that refuge, that peace, that happiness, all of those things, you find them inside instead. And this is one of those fundamental things why Buddhist meditation is so, how it becomes powerful and how it starts to make you withdraw from the world. This is, in the end, that's supposed to be why we become Buddhist monks. It's this kind of understanding that if you want to find real happiness, you have to find it somewhere else. So this is just to give you a little bit of way of reflecting. I'm sure many of you come here because you feel a bit stressed sometimes. Everyone feels a bit stressed sometimes. It's possible for that not to happen. And just that ability to come here and not feel stressed means that you are finding that refuge from the problems of the world to some extent in meditation practice. Even that is already part of that big picture when the world outside is troublesome. So remember that. Just don't bring it up in such a way it makes you kind of depressed and sad. Oh no, the world is so terrible, and you get really depressed, because that doesn't work. That's the wrong way of doing it. I remember there was a few years ago we had Ajahn Brahm sometimes says, he says, oh yeah, the world, you know, it's all dukkha, it's all suffering, it's all terrible. And then he had this enormous grin on his face, yeah, really happy and smiling and radiant while he says that. So the fact that the world is kind of sometimes problematic doesn't mean that you necessarily have to become depressed. The idea is just to turn in a different direction, turn inwards instead, because outwards you're not going to find the same degree of happiness. So use that little perception sometimes, yeah, in the right way to turn you away and turn you inside, and that already helps you to let go a little bit. And once you get that, what's the point of thinking about all of those things if they are problematic, if they will let you down at the end of the day? There's no need to think about those things. Go inside instead. So this is one part of the Buddhist thing. But of course, for that to work, you have to find happiness somewhere else. Yeah, you have to find happiness within. So how can we give rise to the happiness within? What is a skillful means? And the Buddha gives a large number of skillful ways of giving rise to kind of joy inside, or happiness, or clarity, or a bit of brightness inside. And one of the means that he uses is what is called to reflect on your kalyanamittas. Have you heard the word kalyanamitta before? Okay, kalyana means beautiful or good, yeah? And mitta is friend in Pali. It's actually related to metta. We just chanted the Metta Sutta, yeah? Metta and mitta are related to each other. So metta means like friendliness, having loving kindness towards someone is like friendliness, and mitta means friendship. So it means good friendship or spiritual friendship. So the Buddha says, what we do is that we reflect on the fact that we have so many good kalyanamittas, we have so many good spiritual friends. Yeah, because once you realize that you have a kind of a support network, yeah, you have a broader thing, a teaching or whatever it is that is there to support you and guide you in the right way in the world that sometimes you don't really know, you know, what is right and what is wrong, it is incredibly useful. How easy is it to go home and sit and meditate on your own? Far more difficult than when you have a group like this coming together. You kind of create a bit of a group energy sometimes. Sometimes if you become a really good meditator, you may prefer to go in solitude. But for most people, it is good to have a bit of that group energy here, where everybody feels a bit lifted up and supported by others. So this is what you have. Yeah, you have, first of all, the number one kalyanamitta, the number one spiritual friend, is the Buddha. Because the Buddha stands behind all of this. Without the Buddha, we would definitely not be here today. The Buddha gave us these teachings 2,500 years ago. His wonderful teachings about how to find lasting and real happiness in the world, how to avoid suffering, that is what he's known for. He's behind all of this, yeah? The Buddha is your primary kalyanamitta. And then we have like the professional Buddhist practitioners in the world, such as the monastics, yeah? We have a very strong monastic community around Perth. We have a large monks monastery, maybe one of the largest outside of Asia, right here in Perth. We have a good nuns monastery, which is even more rare and more difficult to come by, because nuns are kind of a new phenomenon in the Theravada Buddhist circles. So you have all of this, yeah, people practicing these things professionally, and people like Ajahn Brahm, who is almost world famous for being an extraordinarily good meditator. And then you have all of you, yeah, everyone here today, everyone who comes together, who are spiritual friends, who want to do something good in the world, who want to support each other, want to practice meditation. What a wonderful thing it is to have spiritual friends like this. And then when you think like that, it makes you quite happy, yeah, because you have all of this support network around you, and the support network that includes even the Buddha himself, going back 2,500 years, and everyone else. And all of these people, they are there because they have compassion for you, they want to help you out, they want to support you. The Buddha said that the only reason why he taught at all was because he had compassion for people. He didn't have any ego anymore, ego was completely gone. He had no reason, he had no extra reason outside to teach the Dhamma, apart from the fact that he had compassion and he had the solution to people's problems in life. That's the only two reasons. I have the solution, I have compassion, so I go to teach. That was how the Buddha did this. So this is a way of kind of giving rise to a little bit of joy when you think like that. And it brightens up your mind a little bit, because you feel that there's a force for good available to you through the Buddhist community and through all of these things that are there to support you. I often think like this. I often think how fortunate I am to be part of this enormous thing called Buddhism around the world. And all the support, all the teachings, everything that is part of that. And it makes a refuge that then carries you forward in a positive way. Okay, I better stop because... so let us do some meditation together and see how this works out in practice. Okay, so at the beginning of the meditation, it is always good to just feel the body first of all, to make sure that you're nice and comfortable. And we will be sitting for maybe about half an hour or so, so not too long. So make sure you have a posture that you can sit for roughly half an hour. When you close your eyes, the body comes into, becomes more clear, you can feel the body more clearly. So just feel the body a little bit. Make sure that you're sitting just right. Also relax properly, not only that you are comfortable, but also that you are relaxed, that you have no physical tensions or anything like that. So take as much time as you need to really relax, get the stress out of the system, out of the mind, out of the body, so that you sit here and it's almost as if you can sit here forever. If you have that attitude, then it's going to be very useful for meditation. And at the beginning, as you gradually relax, it is important to just let things be, to allow things to come and go, and not really try to control what you're doing. It is almost as if you are coming home after a long day's work, and you're sitting down on a nice comfortable chair and allowing the world to just go by. You don't do anything at that point. In the same way, at the beginning of the meditation, just allow things to be. There's nothing to be done. There's no meditation that you have to create. It is just about relaxing initially. And then, as you relax in your meditation, you just allow everything to flow. At this point, your mind starts to retract a little bit from the things of the world, and you start to see things flowing along, gradually arising. There's no judgment to be done at this point in meditation. All there is just the watching things coming and going, as if you are a passenger. You're not a driver, you're just enjoying the view in the window. just keep on standing back and observing, not being involved in the flow of things, but allowing things to be. It is a wonderful thing to be able to do that. And you can feel the energy of the mind gradually returning as a consequence. If you find that you are thinking about worldly things, and remind yourself that there is no final solution in those worldly things, to keep on carrying on forever. That is not where you find real happiness. This is where you can find a degree of peace and stillness. So stay with what really matters in life. mind, when you find that you have a degree of clarity in your meditation, a degree of presence, if you wish, you can very gently place your attention on the breath, without controlling, without really pushing it around in any way, but just very gently, with a kind-hearted attitude towards it, then gradually allow the meditation to move from there. And if you do need a bit of extra energy for your meditation there, remember to sometimes just think how fortunate you are to have so many good spiritual companions, companions who support you, companions who wish you well, companions who are there when that little extra kindness is needed to move your meditation forward. What a wonderful thing that is. What a rare opportunity it is to have this in this world. getting close to the end of the meditation. Before we come to the end, I recommend you to always review the meditation slightly before we come to the very last bit, just to try to understand the process, try to understand how it works, this way enabling meditation in the future. Are there any comments or questions about the meditation? Anyone desperate to say anything? Anyone want to say anything about this? Everyone okay? Anyone have a terrible experience? Really, really bad. They want like almost. Sometimes people do, you know. Sometimes people have really bad experience in meditation. And if you do, then you have to adjust a little bit. You can't just carry on like usual. So if that happens, then you just have to relax and not try to do anything really at all, and just relax and just enjoy the atmosphere or whatever, or even just stop it altogether, not do anything, because it is just not pleasant. That happens for some people. Not to anyone here, right? That's true. Anyone? Okay, everyone is good. Okay. Nothing to be said. Yes, please.
There's always that once you get peaceful and nice.
Yeah.
Then there's always that matter of stuff that you've been trying to work out all day or all last week. Issues rise up, things you've been trying to sort out but never bothered thinking much of it. is garbage most.
Yeah.
Any of them or what it is, you know, how you fix something.
Yeah.
Make something work again.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just a strong habit, you know. We always want to problem solve. We only want to kind of, there's so many things going on in our lives, things that need to be sorted out, and so the mind just tends to go there. And this is one of the reasons why, at the beginning, I sort of advised to reflect on the idea of how the world outside is always going to be problematic, and how there is no final solution to those problems. They're always going to carry on and carry on and carry on, and that's why you find yourself in this life in the first place, because as you're trying to solve problems in the past life, and those problems just carry on to the next life, and you keep on going forever like that. So you just have to realize that there is no final solution out there. It just keeps on going, and then you just withdraw from it, because that's not where you're going to find any real peace, any real contentment. If you keep on going there, it will just keep on perpetuating itself forever. So you have to use some strategies like that to sort of see the emptiness, in a sense, in that, and then come back to the peace. But it is a fine line, because the problem is that human beings, we need happiness in life somewhere. Without happiness, life is completely meaningless. And so what we need to do is we kind of need to de-emphasize seeking happiness outside, and at the same time find more peace and happiness within. And as you do that, as one goes down, the other one comes up. It's a gradual exchange, one for the other one. Yeah, that's kind of the ideal way of doing this. And that's why it often takes a long time. It takes a lot of reflection as well, thinking about the world in the right way. And as you do that, you get this exchange happening here. And this can happen within one meditation, but more likely it happens over long periods of time. You know, after coming to the Armada group, year in, year out, suddenly one day something clicks, you know. But it's always like that, isn't it? It's the same thing for monastics as well.
Sometimes it's quite good, though, because it actually gives you time to work, like trying to fix something, obviously, something stupid I'm doing in the shed at home.
Yeah.
And I have them, and I'm like, oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Of course.
And then still thinking, oh, what vision is up there and drill a hole? Good. I hadn't thought of that before. Got rid of all the other stuff. Focus on mind.
Exactly, yeah. The mind becomes a bit more powerful, and you want to use that power straight away. You want to get in there.
Getting off the point. The point isn't to fix all the stuff in the shed.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But this is one of the reasons. This is one of the reasons why we have this idea of right view in Buddhism. And large part of right view is about where to find sustainable happiness and contentment and satisfaction in life. That's a very important part of it. And right view, or the right outlook, or right attitude, whatever you want to call it, it is something that you develop. It's something that you actually have to reflect on. Something you have to purposefully think. You have to think about the world in the right way to make these things happen. And the Buddha says specifically that. In meditation, one of the words for meditation is satipatthana in the suttas, meaning mindfulness meditation or whatever. And it specifically says that meditation practice, which includes watching the breath, is based on right outlook. If you haven't got the right outlook, you will get distracted. You will think about things. You will have the wrong priorities. And then you will think about how to drill that hole in the wall or whatever it is.
Well, and that's another one. I didn't smell
yeah, exactly. That's the way it usually is. Okay. Anyone else? Okay. Is there any questions that I should answer, or is that the case? Or, no. I mean, in the box. Is there no questions in the box?
Nothing in the box.
Okay. Good. Okay. In that case, I shall. What time is it? 8:00 is the announcement, is that right? Okay. We'll see what happens. Probably coming. Okay, so I will talk a little bit, and if you wish to ask questions as we go along, please do so. And we'll see what happens, see what comes out of this. And usually the things that I like to talk about are things that are happening in life, things that are kind of current and are important to me, and maybe to the world in general. Because these are things that, I don't know, easy to talk about. That's the reason why I talk about those things. And recently we had this tragedy in Sri Lanka where 250, 60 people died because of terrorist bombing. And a few weeks before that, my own father died, passed away back in Norway. Norway is where I'm from originally. He died, so I had to fly back very quickly and to sort of, you know, organize the funeral services and all those kind of things. It's interesting, as a monk, you're supposed to have contemplated death, you're supposed to be pretty cool about these things, but you never really know what's going to happen until these things actually hit you. That's when you kind of get the test. You have to see if it's going to, if you can deal with it, or how you react to these things. So that was very interesting in one way, and I did find that, that my kind of practice has borne fruit. I wasn't terribly sad. The way I kind of reacted to the funeral was more kind of what you would expect, I think, from a Buddhist monk. And I want to talk a little bit about that. What can you expect if you practice in the right way in a long time to deal with these big problems in life, such as the people closest to you passing away and these kind of things. When I went back, one of the first things that I could see straight away was people saying things like, oh, it happened so quickly here. It happened so fast. I didn't really have time to say goodbye properly or to, you know, have a last kind of talk about things or whatever it is. And this is something that I have seen happening so many times when people pass away. People say it happened so quickly here. It happened so fast. And even in cases where people are in the hospital, on a hospital bed, they have cancer, doctor has said it will pass away in a few days. Still then, people say it happened so quickly, happened so fast. Because we always have a tendency to think, if it's going to happen tomorrow, it's not going to be today. It's always, we tend to postpone it a little bit. It's very hard to take on board the fact that death can happen at any time. It can happen right now, basically. So this is one of the things, and when I hear that, I always recognize that people have not done, from a Buddhist point of view, enough death contemplation. The idea that death is always around the corner, you never know what's going to happen next, everything that is dear and pleasing to you, as the Buddha says, has to become otherwise. Everything that is dear and pleasing to you, everyone that is dear and pleasing to you, must become otherwise. We all have to be parted from these things. And as you gradually take these things on board, gradually something inside of you changes. And you start to, almost like you expect things to happen. Weird things that are painful and problematic, you almost expect them to happen. Because you know the world is inherently impermanent, inherently out of control, inherently always changeable, always kind of moving from one thing to another one. So when I got the phone call that my father had passed away, I thought, I expected that. You know, in my father's case, it was fairly obvious. He had cancer. He had cancer for a few years. Towards the end, he was getting very weak and very bad. So the very last thing, he fell down a long flight of stairs, and landed on a kind of hard stone floor and basically crushed himself completely to pieces. And that was how he died. So for some people that was kind of unexpected, but when someone is so sick, you can expect these kind of things to happen. This is just the way things tend to go. So I wasn't surprised. Some people were surprised, but I thought, in many ways, it's a good way to go. You have all this cancer, the body's falling apart, your quality of life is really going down, and then you fall down the flight of stairs and you die almost instantaneously. Maybe that was a good thing. I'm not sure if kind of, you know, having to go through that cancer treatment over a few more months with the chemotherapy and all that kind of stuff really is all that useful. So I think maybe it was a good way to go in many ways. So that is how I looked at it. And I look at other people, they were kind of much more distraught by this because they weren't used to this idea.
Sorry, Adam. It's got an interesting stuff, really good. Other people would have been there as well, obviously, friends, brothers and sisters and stuff like that. You have siblings?
Yeah, sure, yeah, yeah.
And so,
yeah.
You know, sort of stark difference between you actually and theirs, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean by this, basically, that they were kind of more, you know, they happen so fast, this kind of thing, that's what the kind of sort of reaction that they would have. Whereas I was more used to the idea. This was the main thing.
So how did they react to your reaction?
Oh, to my reaction? Okay, okay. Sometimes people do think that. They think that, they wonder how we can be so cool about these things and not really be more emotionally involved. And they're doing, so this is kind of a typical thing here that happens. And I think that they don't realize the benefits of kind of contemplating these things over long periods of time, and how it kind of makes you a bit more withdrawn. You can see the world a bit more, with a bit more clarity. You haven't got, you're not so infiltrated and so kind of attached and so caught up in everything yet. You have more withdrawn from all of those things. And that actually, over time, and I've been a monk now for 25 years almost, over time it starts to make a big impact on you. And you, it's almost as if you do expect these things to happen. But of course, when you do expect these things to happen, one of the first things that occurs to you is that you have to make peace with everyone in your life. You can't really go around have enemies anymore. You can't have bad relationships with people, because if death is always around the corner, if you were to die today and you had a bad relationship with somebody, you've done something wrong, you feel really bad about it. That is when you really feel bad about death, if you have some unresolved business. So because of that, I understood fairly early on in my monastic life that I really needed to kind of change my attitude, especially to my parents, and to deal with my relationship with them in a very positive way. And I did that. Initially, when you become a monastic, you're very keen on the Buddhist teachings, and you want to convert the whole world. Yeah, that's why I'm here today, to convert all of you guys, making sure you're really properly converted. So you want to convert everyone, including your family and your parents and whatever. But after a while, you realize that's the wrong way to go about converting people, to kind of tell them about these teachings. The right way is to live these teachings. So I started to do that. And I, of course, a big part of the Buddhist teaching is to kind of treat your family and your friends and your parents, especially, in a good way. Yeah, having a sense of gratitude for your parents and all these kind of things. So I started doing that, and I started to ask for forgiveness for any stupidity I did as a teenager. Yeah, I did many stupid things as a teenager. I'm not going to talk about that tonight, but you know what it's like. So letting go of those unfortunate things, and at the same time building up positive things. Yeah, and this had a very transformative effect on my relationship to my parents, and especially to my father. Very, very transformative. Initially, when I became a monk, my father was rather not very pleased, yeah, as you might expect, but actually quite displeased. What? You're going to become a Buddhist monk for? Not very happy about that at all. But of course, he allowed me to become a Buddhist monk, because he realized you can't really stop your children from doing what they really want to do in life. But after a while, after living in the right way and doing what I think is appropriate to do as a son to your parents, gradually the whole attitude changed. And eventually, towards the very end, my parents were basically Buddhist. Yeah, my father was a Buddhist. He was listening to Dhamma talks, he was listening to my teachings that go on YouTube, and he was starting to read Buddhist books. And whenever I went back home, he would ask me to do meditation together and give a little Dhamma talk to my family, which is quite astonishing. Yeah. And I realized that I had, succeeded somehow. So I felt that I had actually done the right thing. I had said all the things I wanted to say. I said, I talked to him about all the things I appreciated about him and growing up and all these kind of things. I had said what needed to be said. And I felt that it was nothing. When he died, I had done what I could do. And for that reason, I felt very at ease and very relaxed. So that was one of the focuses that I, kind of made it very easy for me to let go, I think. I felt there was no kind of unresolved business there going on. Anyway, so I went back to Norway, and I felt kind of relaxed about things, and I, for that reason also, you have more ability to help out your family members, yeah, because you have a bit more clarity. And then we prepared for the funeral service, and I said that I would like to do the whole service, and which is very nice. Yeah, it's really nice to be able to do a funeral service as a final goodbye for your father, to thank him, to wish him well on his onward journey and these kind of things. So I did the whole service there, and which was very interesting, because I'm used to doing funeral service. I do quite a few of them here in Perth as well, but usually the people are Buddhist. Yeah, but these were all my father's friends, and some of my friends were there, and some of my sister's and brother's friends were there, my mother's friends were there. So these were all kind of the larger family circle, yeah, that were there. None of them, not a single one of them, except for maybe my closest family members, were Buddhist. There was over 200 people coming to this funeral, and I was the only real Buddhist there, and everyone else had no idea about the Buddhist teachings. So, of course, if I was going to hold a funeral service, obviously it was going to have some Buddhist content. Yeah, that's, that kind of goes without saying it. But I also realized that if you're going to speak to people who have no Buddhist background, you have to be very careful how you present the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, you can't present it as some kind of zealot who's going to convert everyone and do lots of Buddhist chanting, that kind of stuff. You have to find a very middle way to people who are not used to these teachings. And that's exactly what I did. I applied Buddhist principles, but in a very neutral way. And afterwards, in this large crowd of complete non-Buddhists and no idea about Buddhism, they were rather shocked probably to see a Buddhist monk standing up and holding the service in the first place. They said, what a wonderful thing that was. This is the best funeral service we ever had. Christian funeral services tend to be all very sad and very kind of depressing. This is the first time I felt inspired about a funeral service. And I thought that was very interesting. It was very, very, very nice. Yes, Father.
You're not moving back to Norway, are you?
Well, not tomorrow. So, and what was interesting about that is that you realize that the world, the world which is not Buddhist, the world of ordinary people out there who often have no religion at all, except for enjoying material wealth and BMWs and that kind of stuff, they are ready for these Buddhist teachings. They are ready to hear them, as long as you present them in a way that actually is accessible to people. And I think this is one of the things that we need to do in Buddhism. We need to kind of lower a little bit the threshold of, to make these things more accessible, to lower it in such a way that people are not afraid when they come towards Buddhist teachings. What are people afraid of? Well, what they are afraid of are things that are overly religious, things that are kind of too much rituals, that kind of stuff. So we need to kind of, I think, lower the entry ability of people so they can actually access these teachings more clearly, because I think there is an enormous potential in the world for people to hear these teachings and actually understand that there is so much wonderful going on here that people could access and use to improve their life, quality of their life, and all these kinds of things. So this is one of the things that I think I learned from this, because here was an ordinary chapel. It was really quite unreligious, the whole thing. The only religious symbol was really my robes. That was really all. Everything else was quite secular and nice, and people really enjoyed it. So what did I say to these people? This is kind of the standard thing that you say at the Buddhist funeral. And these are the kind of things that make a moment of death quite meaningful. Very simple things, but things that everyone can really appreciate. And the first thing I talked about was just my father's good qualities. And saying that we all know that death is going to happen sooner or later. So death is not really the issue. The issue is how we have lived our lives. If we have lived our lives well, that is really all we can do. We cannot expect not to die. That would be absolutely crazy. But what we can do, we can either choose to live our lives well or we can live them badly. If we live our lives well, and if someone dies, actually there's every reason to be happy and to celebrate what is going on. To celebrate a life lived well, and then we're actually on the right track, thinking about death in the right way. So this is the first thing. Remember all the good qualities in someone, and then celebrate a good existence rather than grieve over someone who actually has departed. And I will talk a little bit more about that in a second. And the second thing, and this is the thing which often you find, this is probably some teaching you've heard before, and this is the teaching that Ajahn Chah used to give to his to the lay people and the monastics. Ajahn Chah was Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand. And what he did apparently sometimes, he would have a glass, and he would hold up the glass, and he would say to the audience, maybe there was lots of people present, maybe thousands of people there, and he would say, look at that glass, can you see the crack in this glass? Can you see the crack, Bob, in that glass? You can't see it. Really? You're looking properly?
Yeah.
Doug, can you see it?
No,
yeah. Okay, so the point is, point is that a glass is fragile, a glass is very vulnerable there. So the crack is already there, in the sense that we know one day the glass is going to come off the table, it's going to fall on a hard floor, maybe it won't break here, but if it fell on a tile floor, it probably would break it. Because the glass is fragile, by definition, it will one day break apart and will fall apart. So the crack is already there. It might be invisible to Doug, but it's already there. It's waiting to fall apart or to break apart. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that when a glass is fragile and is vulnerable in that sense, we care for it. You don't throw the glass on the ground as if it was a rubber ball. Instead, you put it back carefully and gently in the right way, and then you're looking after it. And it's exactly in the same way with life. People are fragile, people are vulnerable. These bodies go wrong all the time through accidents, through death, through whatever it is, through illnesses. And because people are vulnerable and fragile in this way, because remember that, we care for the people around us in the same way that we care for the glass. So this is one of those beautiful things about death. Once you understand the idea of death and impermanence, how things always moving on, always so uncertain, the next moment someone can just fall down and be dead. Once you recognize that, you care more for the people around you. So fragility and vulnerability, if you think about it in the right way, actually gives rise to morality, it gives rise to kindness, it gives rise to a way of treating people that is more positive and more wholesome and leads to our and other people's happiness as a consequence. And this is a very beautiful way of turning things upside down. Instead of something just being sad, we turn it into a force for good in the world instead. If I know I may never see you again, I may never see you again, this may be the last time. Maybe I will die, maybe one of you will die. Who knows, maybe I will move back to Norway, is that right, Bob? Who knows, never see you again. So if I never see you again, how am I going to treat you? I will treat you well, I don't want to treat you badly the last time I see you. What a terrible thing that is. So I want to try to be kind to you, try to do the right thing, so we can say goodbye on good terms, and that we can move on happily into our future, wherever that may be. So this is the first thing I said to these people. Yeah, it's not very religious, it's just blooming obvious, if you really. So they kind of, oh yeah, that makes sense, yeah, and they were kind of nod, I actually didn't look at them, but they probably nodded in the audience there. And the second thing I said to them was about how to perceive or think about the situation when somebody passes away. And this is another very beautiful way of turning something around by a very simple trick of perception. And Ajahn Brahm always uses the story, it's a beautiful story about when he was a young man, he went to concerts in London, and he went to his beautiful concerts, and he was kind of in the middle of the concert mecca in London in the 1960s, when kind of all the kind of some of the big bands later on, the Who and whatever, kind of was starting out in London. He went to these nightclubs there. But it doesn't have to be a concert, it can be any kind of peak experience that you have in your life. It can be, maybe you have a nature experience where you feel really peaceful or really something very happy arises in your mind. It can be a concert, it can maybe be something other kind of entertainment that you enjoy, or it can even be a meditation experience when you have this kind of peak, wow, that was really powerful and amazing. It's as if you are transported out of your ordinary life into some extraordinary experience, a kind of experience that leaves an impact on you for the rest of your life. You can never really forget it afterwards. So what happens when that experience comes to an end? Because they always come to an end. This is the problem, right? And this is why we have the spiritual path to kind of make these things last a little bit longer. What happens when I come to an end is that you have to come back to your ordinary life again. You have to deal with all the ordinary things and compare to one of these peak experiences that transports you out of your ordinary self. Ordinary life seems so grey, it seems so kind of ordinary, this is the word ordinary, kind of means grey, it means ordinary, common. And then there's two ways you can deal with that. One is you can think back to that experience that you had, I went to this wonderful concert, I was really transported to another realm, and how terrible it is, how sad it is that now that experience has disappeared, and then you can grieve and be sad because you haven't got that experience anymore. That is one way of dealing with it, and that leads to sadness. You are focusing on what you have lost. But there is another way of thinking about that experience, and that is to think that in my ordinary life, in my ordinary existence, how lucky I was, just a minute, I'll get back to you, how lucky I was to have this opportunity to experience something exceptional, because my ordinary life is so ordinary compared to this. How fortunate I was to be able to come to the Armored Leg group and have a beautiful meditation experience. Yeah? Is that right? Yeah? Okay, great. And so then you understand that instead of focusing on what you have lost, you focus on what you have gained, on how something has enriched your life and made your life better. And of course, it is exactly the same thing with death. Yeah. When I think about my father, I have a lot of gratitude towards him. He was a very good father. He was very kind to me in very many ways when I was a child and when I was young. He supported me throughout my education and everything. He was never really angry. Well, of course, sometimes he was angry. He never touched me physically in any way at all, because that's not done where I came from Norway. But also, he wasn't that kind of person who would, physical violence was completely against his nature. And so everything was very positive. And when I even asked to become a Buddhist monk, still he said yes. Yeah, that was the most miraculous of all kind of things. Yeah, he said yes to becoming a Buddhist monk. Yeah. So everything, all the way through, always supportive, always caring, always kind. And because of that, I really thank him. Thank you so much for having been such a good father, for having supported me in this way. And that this feeling of gratitude instead of feeling sorrow. Of course he's going to die. But instead of focusing on the loss, I try to focus on what? On the positive aspects of that relationship. And then I tend to feel gratitude instead. So this is what I was telling this audience, yeah. Before I go any further, would you like to?
No, it's just that I have to go early, but I just wanted to say I thoroughly enjoyed your talk.
Yeah. Okay.
I think you've been one of the best speeches, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Very good. Okay.
I have to go early. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Okay. Very good. Glad you enjoyed it. So. Yeah.
I read Ajahn Brahm's piece after my dad passed away. First time I read it, I threw it aside and I thought, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mentioned it to my friend and she said, you didn't understand it. She said, read it again.
Yeah.
And I read it again and I still said, I don't understand it. She said, read it again. And I had to read it three times before it sunk in and I understood what Ajahn Brahm was trying to say.
Yeah. Good, exactly. And that's the thing, because we are so conditioned to think about things in a certain way.
Yes,
actually,
yes.
It takes a lot to kind of turn our conditioning around and think about things in a different way.
Yes.
And especially if you are in the middle of grieving already, sometimes it can be even more difficult.
Yes.
Sometimes you have to do it before you get to that point.
And I thought,
I said to these people, because these are the things that I have kind of grown up with as a Buddhist monk, and the response was just astonishing, because I'm not used to hearing these kind of things, but people got it, because really, when you think about it, when you have a clear mind, when you're not in the middle of the grieving, as you are, you can see there's actually a lot of sense in this thing, a lot of sensible way of thinking about life and how to deal with difficult situations. So that is was my experience when I went back to Norway and did my father's funeral. And it was a very positive experience for me. It might make sense sound very strange, but that's exactly what it was. Of course, for my mother, it is much, much more difficult because she has lived with my father for over 60 years. And then it leaves a massive gap, a gaping hole in your life, and very difficult to deal with that at age, especially when you are already 80 years old or whatever. It's very hard to deal with. But there is that potential for looking at these things differently, and that is what is so fascinating about this. Of course, in the Buddha's teachings, the way the Buddha talks about these things, I'm only going to go on for a few more minutes, the way the Buddha talks about these things is exactly in this way. Yeah, he talks about the idea of being separated from everything that is dear and pleasing to you, and getting used to that idea and thinking about it. And what is interesting about Buddhism is that when the Buddha started out, before he was even the Buddha, the thing that actually made him become a monk, because he was a monk, he probably looked a little bit like this, not exactly like this, but a little bit like this, he was a monk. The thing that made him a monk was contemplation of death. This is really the main thing. Yeah, it's very fascinating. When the Buddha, before he was the Buddha to be, when he grew up in quite a bit of luxury, quite luxurious for that time. He wasn't the prince, as the later tradition has it, but he grew up in quite a bit of luxury. And luxury in those days meant that as a young man you had three lotus ponds. The Buddha had three lotus ponds. Yeah, so in those days, young men, if they want to enjoy themselves, they had three lotus ponds. One with red lotuses, one with blue, and one with white. Yeah, that was 2,500 years ago, how the young men enjoyed themselves. Things have changed just a little bit in the kind of intervening time.
PlayStation, Xbox, 14.
Not mentioned the sutras, yeah, it's kind of, yeah. So the deprived childhood, they call, is that what they call it? Or maybe actually it wasn't, maybe it was the exact opposite. And then, of course, amid all this luxury, he also had other things. He had kind of the best kind of clothes, of course, all this kind of stuff. But then, in the middle of all this, he also realized that there is a big downside in this thing, and that is precisely old age and death, that everyone eventually has to pass away, including himself. But not just himself, but all the things in the world that he wanted to, was interested in, having a wife and children and maybe a house and possessions and all these kind of things. Everything that he was to, was to kind of accumulate in this way, in terms of relationships and possessions, all of those things also had a kind of a send-by date, or a date by which they would actually disappear. Yeah, everything was subject to death. All the people in his life. So he realized, here I am. I am myself subject to death. And now what I'm doing, I'm attaching and holding on to all of these other things that also are subject to death. I'm building up all this potential suffering for the future. Because if we go out and we attach to too many things in the world, what we're asking for is really suffering. Yeah, this is the problem. This is exactly what is going on. That's why death is so difficult. That is why when we have to let go of things, it can be so hard, because we are attached to these things. But the difference with the Buddha compared to most of us, that he saw this in such a deep way that he actually decided on the spot, there's only one thing to do. I've got to solve this whole problem with death. I have to go forth from the whole life and become a monastic instead. And then, of course, based on that idea of dying, based on the idea of death, the problem of death, the Buddha then went forth, he became a monk, he practiced, he found what is called awakening in the Buddhist suttas, which means basically an insight into the nature of existence, but a very profound one. And he discovered the highest happiness, according to the suttas, that is available to humanity or a human being. That is what his life is all about, overcoming suffering and finding happiness. And then, based on that, he started this religion, this teaching called Buddhism. He taught it to the whole world, and that is why we're sitting here now, in Armadale, listening to this thing 2,500 years later. It's kind of cool, isn't it? It all started for one thing, because one man thought about death in a very profound way. That is why we are sitting here together now, 2,500 years later. Isn't that kind of amazing? Yeah, here is the greatest spiritual genius in human history. That's what I call the Buddha, the greatest spiritual genius in human history. And the reason why he became that spiritual genius is because he contemplated and thought about death in a very profound way. That is how important the death contemplation is in Buddhism. And that is why the Buddha said that anyone who is serious about the spiritual life, whether they are a lay person, whether they are a monastic, whether they are a woman or a man, or whatever they are, death contemplation is one of the things that everyone should think about, because the potential for that to transform your life is so powerful. Like, for example, like I just mentioned before, if you really take on board the death contemplation, you can never afford to have an enemy in your life. You always make sure that you treat people in the right way, because people can pass away at any time. Simple little thing, but very powerful, and it changes your attitude to yourself and to the people around you in a very powerful way. Okay, that's it. So.
Thank you, Ezra.
Yeah, very good.
Very good. Yeah.